From Buffalo, Toronto Public Media and WBFO, this is What's Next Producers Picks, highlights of a conversation heard on a previous episode. On today's show...
This goes back to how certain people have this arrogance about history, right? July 4th should only be our only Independence Day. And that's impossible with all the different groups of people that we have that have lived in this country who have been oppressed by those people that believed in independence.
UB Center for K through 12 Black History and Racial Literacy Director LeGarrett King. I'm Thomas O'Neill White. First, we revisit my conversation with LeGarrett King. We discuss all things Juneteenth, from the significance of the holiday to how we can continue to honor the holiday and other Black liberation celebrations. We talk about Juneteenth. The celebrations continue to grow. What is the historical significance of this day?
So the popular story with Juneteenth is the concept of, you know, after the Civil War, June 19th, 1864, one of the Union generals, Granger, you know, came, and I believe some dockers out in Galveston, Texas, you know, were the first people to hear the concepts that, you know, Black people were now free in the United States, right? And this was, you know, a few years after the Emancipation Proclamation and a few months after, like, the total surrender, you know, of the South, to the Union, right? Union Army, So that's the popular story, you know, to that. But there's several different kind of misconceptions, you know, around the concept of Juneteenth.
What are those misconceptions?
Well, the way in which we kind of understand Juneteenth is that Juneteenth was Black Independence Day, right? But throughout history, there was never a singular Black Emancipation Day, or Black Freedom Day, In the United States alone, from 1780 to 1865, we've had 20 Emancipation Days throughout the country, that different communities celebrate throughout the year, So certain places, you know, don't celebrate Juneteenth, but they celebrate some form of emancipation, like in Washington, D.C., in April, they celebrate their Emancipation Day because that's when, you know, enslaved people in Washington, D.C. were free, per se, from slavery, Some people celebrate the Emancipation Proclamation, So some people may be real familiar with going to church on New Year's Eve, And then they get out at New Year's, That was a celebration that was connected to the Emancipation Proclamation because of January 1st, 1863, when the Emancipation Proclamation was there, I read somewhere else that Florida celebrates May 20th as their Emancipation Day because that's when the state freed their slaves, So so there's several different freedom days throughout the country, but Juneteenth has been kind of allocated as the Black Independence Day, which sometimes we have to be careful with.
And it's interesting that something that was celebrated originally in Galveston, Texas, has made its way all the way to Buffalo, New York, and it's celebrated.
Well, you know, Buffalo, of course, is part of the Great Migration. You know, a lot of people come from Mississippi and Alabama and Georgia and all those particular places, and they come and they bring their celebrations to, you know, the city, But also, I think we need to kind of rethink how we think about Juneteenth, Not only were there multiple Emancipation Days, we also have to be very careful of kind of that white savior narrative, You know, like, oh, the Union, you know, came and saved Black people, because that just erases a lot of our history, particularly our history around agency, Black folk, of course, freed themselves all the time, you know, by running away from different plantation sites. You had these independent maroon colonies that sprung up, particularly within, you know, the water areas.
Virginia. Southern Virginia.
Maroon colonies.
That's where my dad is from.
So you've had these enslaved, escaped slave folk, plus indigenous folks, sometimes coming together and creating their own communities and, you know, going and saving different people from different plantations, et cetera, et cetera. So, Black Independence Day is great. It's something that, you know, we will celebrate, but just historically, we have to understand that there has never been a time where there's only one Black Independence Day for Black folk. There's several.
So how do those Emancipation Days, along with Juneteenth, you know, how do they relate to other significant moments in African American history, like, as you brought up, the Emancipation Proclamation, like the Civil Rights Movement?
Mm-hmm. So when we learn about these different histories of Black history, the main kind of caveat I think people need to really understand, because sometimes you hear young people say certain things, you know, I don't know, on social media or, you know, in their classrooms, that is just ahistorical, right?
Like, right.
So there's this popular phrase, particularly like used during the Black Lives Matter movement. Hey, this is not your mama's and daddy's civil rights movement and all this stuff. And because we're more this and we're more that, you know, we want to. So this assumption is that, despite the fact that Black people have historically been oppressed, you know, throughout history, there has always been strategies to make us free, right? To push against that oppression, right? So these particular independent days just show us, right, throughout history, that Black people have always fought for their freedom.
Right.
Right. And yes, sometimes they didn't fight, you know, sometimes through nonviolence and being meek and being passive, right?
Mm-hmm. That's always the prevailing story. Mm-hmm. And to me, there's something nefarious behind that. No, you have to do it this way, this other way that we're not going to talk about.
Well, why do we kind of approach, you know, kind of civil rights in that manner, right? So, you know, I've been in several different classrooms before, and I've listened to teachers teach about civil rights and civil rights movement. And there's a certain push for, hey, the best way to achieve freedom is through kind of quote unquote nonviolence.
Right.
While we're learning about the violence that is happening towards the people who were nonviolent.
Exactly.
Right. And, you know, then you get to, oh, Malcolm X and the Panthers and all this. But even way before that, right, mm-hmm. Kelly Carter Jackson has a new book out called We Resist. And she channels the history of Black people resisting through various different means, both violence and nonviolence. But the violence aspect is very interesting, right?
Mm-hmm.
Because it's like, hey, people didn't just sit around, right? There were slave revolts. There were black people owned guns. There were shootouts. There were this and that, all for, you know, the credence of freedom, right? So a lot of these young people, right, you know, particularly those that say those phrases, trust me, your grandmother was a beast probably.
Granny knew what was up. You mentioned the different emancipation celebrations, but specifically speaking of Juneteenth, because yes, there's a celebration here, there are celebrations down south. Do they vary from region to region, from state to state, for the states that do celebrate Juneteenth?
Yeah, I think there's a lot of similarities and differences, right? You, of course, within really Black cities, Texas, like Houston, Dallas, Austin to a certain extent, San Antonio to a certain extent, you'll have more elaborate Juneteenth celebrations, mainly because they've done it a lot, right?
Yes.
You know, but there's some similarities, right? So these Juneteenth celebrations, of course, you know, you have the cookouts, right, that people may have, which may be something more intimate, like a family reunion, or it could be something more citywide, you know, that's combined with like a festival type of, you know, setting. So it's a celebration. You have mm-hmm. musical artists, you have dancing, you have education, you have vendors, et cetera, et cetera. So you have those particular spaces. You also have places that have Juneteenth pageants, right? Places that may have educational aspects at libraries, right? So, but most places kind of take that approach, you know, to celebrate. So it's a main like celebration of just life and Black culture and Black people.
As an aside, I kind of compare it to Southern hip hop.
Okay.
If you're not familiar with each city's style, you kind of think it's all the same.
Yeah.
But like Atlanta rappers, not really the same as Miami rappers, who are not exactly the same as Memphis or New Orleans or Houston. Talk about the same stuff, but maybe the slang's a little different.
Yeah.
Their cadence is different. You know, their accents are different, but it's all variations of Black hip hop culture. That's what I've always equated it to.
Yeah. And for the places that really celebrated and have been celebrating real good, I do understand Buffalo has a rich history for their Juneteenth. And I think UB has a group of people that will march, you know, during the parade. And so I know these people are very excited about that.
You've taught in the South, Georgia and Texas specifically. You mentioned off air, you didn't teach about Juneteenth just because it was, you know, the school session was out, but there's definitely community events surrounding Juneteenth.
Yeah, we would definitely mention it if you're teaching like U.S. history survey course and
okay.
you're talking about the end of the war. You know, you'll bring up, hey, this is what began Juneteenth. And this was way before Juneteenth became a federal holiday for me.
Okay. Mm-hmm. And you mentioned, obviously, Juneteenth is a federal holiday. What about other Emancipation Days, you know, being more widely recognized as a holiday? Does that seem like an uphill battle for you, given, especially given our current social and political climate?
Well, I've been noticing online and in various different things that I read that there is kind of a conservative pushback on, you know, Juneteenth, right? Calling it made up, which reality check, all holidays are made up, right? Like, there's no, like someone said, hey, I want to celebrate this, and then they create whatever.
Yes.
And so all holidays are made up. So I've seen that, right? And going back to this concept of being nefarious, it's like, dang, black folk can't have anything. But to be fair, I don't think any black person really was calling for Juneteenth to be a federal holiday, really.
Mm-hmm.
But we got it, right?
Yes.
So now let's celebrate it, right? because this goes back to how certain people have this arrogance about history, right? July 4th should only be our only Independence Day. And that's impossible with all the different groups of people that we have that have lived in this country who have been oppressed by those people that believed in independence, right?
Right.
So that's a very arrogant statement to say, hey, Juneteenth is made up when July 4th is made up as well. But when I think about why we celebrate it, right, we really celebrate as a big party, right?
Yeah.
Because, you know, the saying goes, I think, like, after the black dock workers heard General Granger, they celebrated for 7 days straight, right? Using the black church because that was the safest place, you know, to do those things. But there's something about certain groups of people not wanting black people to be joyful.
Right.
Right. And while we can...
Policing that joy.
Policing the joy. And it's weird. Right. It's like, because beforehand, I've known communities that have celebrated Juneteenth or at least understood what Juneteenth was, and white people knew nothing about it.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And didn't even really care to know. Right. And then all of a sudden there's this like, hey, we care about it. Right.
Yeah.
So it's weird. But yeah, the celebration should be pushed everywhere. Everyone should, you know, join and learn a lot, you know, about the different aspects, because while Juneteenth is a joyous celebration, we also have to understand that the history behind these Emancipation Days haven't always been joyful, right?
Mm-hmm.
So what's interesting is there's kind of three characteristics around these Emancipation Days that happened to black people. Number one, there was always this gradual emancipation.
Mm-hmm.
Right. That, you know, black folks just couldn't be free right then and there.
Right.
There's always this gradual, even the Emancipation Proclamation. It was just like those states that were covered by the North and not the states that were still slave states. You know, those people were, you know, slaves. But there's always a gradual aspect. Also, while you may have a law, right, whether it's federal or local or whatever the case may be, you still have the same Congress people that didn't believe that black people should be free, right? So a law is only good if it's enforced.
Exactly.
Right? You know? And then last, and probably the most interesting aspect about these Emancipation Days, is that essentially black people had to pay to be free. are being debted to be free, while slave owners benefited and got reparations, you know, for losing their quote unquote property. Right. So you see this all the time, you know, throughout history. So those types of things need to be learned. Right. So as we move forward with various different aspects, particularly the reparations debate, right, and studying reparations and studying who needs to have reparations, those aspects, even when Black people are free, there's suffering that comes along with that freedom.
As an educator and talking about the need for people to be educated on these topics, it must be discouraging to see parts of the country and the school boards outright banning books. Mm-hmm. And a lot of those from, you know, African-American authors, African-American perspectives.
Yeah. And it's also very frustrating since we're only 4 years removed from the quote unquote racial reckoning. Right.
Right.
Everyone was down for, you know, diversity education. Everyone was down for trying to understand the history of our country. And then all of a sudden, in a snap of a finger, everybody kind of.
It's like the Thanos snap.
It's like, yeah. All the pearls were gone. It was just like, wow, you know, it's crazy. And I guess what's more heartening is that people who kind of understand history knew that there was going to be a backlash somewhere.
Right.
Right.
There always is.
Right. We knew that there was going to be a backlash for Barack Obama.
Mm-hmm.
Right. You know, because I mean, I remember thinking, I hope this brother make it his first 4 years, right?
Mm-hmm.
And I was surprised he got a second 4 years, right?
Right.
So I was just kind of waiting on, well, where's the backlash? And you saw it boiling over these 8 years and all these narratives and discourses about all this stuff. And then it, you know, kind of proceeded with the election of a certain person and the ideology and what that person kind of stood for, right? Mm-hmm. Or that person represented what these people stood for, right?
Exactly.
Type of aspects, yeah. Right? So go back to the question.
Oh, just being discouraged in seeing these book bannings.
I guess I'm more kind of discouraged because we had all these people who said, we believe this and we want to learn more. We want to do this. You know, we want to push for equity. We want to push. And then all of a sudden, it seems like there's been a very weak pushback against these racist policies and anti-Black policies that are going on in certain school boards and school systems, right? So, yeah, it's very discouraging when there's so much that we need to learn about our country so we do not repeat those same things that we've been repeating for 400 years.
Mm-hmm. So what's the solution to this problem?
Man, the solution will be a hard one because, of course, if we had a solution, we wouldn't be doing this, right?
Yeah.
Over and over and over and over and over again, right? I don't know what's going on in the political sphere where there seems to be some type of helpless, you know, since we are in a majority two-party system, that one party doesn't seem like another party who is supposed to be against those things are pushing hard enough, you know, to stop those things from happening. It seems like something is helpless, or they're helpless in doing these things. I think community members need to be a little bit more advocate for those things, run for school boards. School boards are a very interesting political entity, right? Because a lot of
it's not supposed to be political, right?
Yeah. and you'll notice that school boards, particularly for those who want to be politicians, are typically kind of that first in way to, you know, political aspects.
Right.
Yeah, school boards are not supposed to be political in that nature, but they are very much so. But yeah, people, I would encourage people to, you know, run for the school boards and other local elections, particularly if they care about those particular issues. Education is extremely important in this, right? I still do believe if people know more, they do better.
Mm-hmm.
Right. Because, you know, we keep on falling for the same discourses each generation, mainly because we're not educated. Right.
Right.
So, yeah, more activism within the communities and within places where people have some type of influence.
And how can people on an individual level best honor the legacy of Juneteenth and these other emancipation holidays and its importance to American history?
I think for individuals, we need to begin to start sharing educational books and articles about Juneteenth. I know there's a lot of people on social media that do, you know, small reels on it because that's kind of the popular way that people like to learn now, I think. And just spread the word and maybe even have more neighborhood focus aspects for Juneteenth, because I know Buffalo has a large one for the city, but it would be amazing to see particularly mixed neighborhoods. Mm-hmm. You have different celebrations with speakers and other celebrations.
It would be nice.
Within those particular spaces, right?
This is What's Next, and we're talking with LeGarrette King from the University of Buffalo. LeGarrette, I wanted to get your opinion on a news story that has come up recently. Mm-hmm. The Oklahoma Supreme Court dismissed the lawsuit by the survivors of the racist massacre in Tulsa in 1921. The plaintiffs had been seeking reparations for over 100 years, and they're all, you know, 102, 103 years old. What does that decision by the Oklahoma Supreme Court say to you?
That black lives do not matter. When we look at the history of the United States, there has been several groups that have received reparations for things that were done to them by the U.S. government, different communities. And this is a different approach than a national call for reparations, right? Because now you have a small group of people within a local city that we have the pull yourselves up from the bootstraps mentality here. And mm-hmm. we had a group that pulled themselves up from the bootstraps,
exactly.
right? What? One generation. And they built, you know, this part of town, like in other parts of the United States where black communities created their black wall streets, right?
Right.
Throughout the country. And it was destroyed in a matter of hours and days, right? So their properties was lost. And I thought the United States was very prominent in this notion of property. Your property matters. And these people's properties and their way of life were turned upside down. Some people had to move and all these particular things. And for those people not to receive reparations is disheartening. And it continues to prove that there's a layered system of justice that we have in the United States. And, you know, for the people who always come, who get the short end of the stick, is always black folk. And this has been something that everyone knows now.
Right.
Right? You know, we know the history. Mm-hmm. And we've been knowing the history for years. Movies and documentaries. People have testified in front of Congress about these things. And for them not to receive reparations for Tulsa is anti-black, racist, and disheartening.
And along those lines, we in Western New York recently recognized the second anniversary of the racist massacre here in the city of Buffalo. There's been differing opinions on how far we've progressed with regards to race relations in the region and addressing the socioeconomic issues plaguing parts of Buffalo's east side. Mm-hmm. Does it seem like we still have a long way to go in those areas?
It does seem that way. I know there was major talk about socioeconomic improvements within the area. I'm not sure if those promises have been fulfilled. I'm not privy to meetings or, you know, strategies, but of course it doesn't really seem like business as usual, right?
Mm-hmm.
For the city of Buffalo and the way in which they treat their black citizens. So in terms of race relations, I don't think we moved the needle that much. You know, the problem, I think a lot of times these conversations, because someone would, you know, kind of combat it and say, well, no, there's no discrimination, there's no this or no that. But we really don't look at kind of institutional policies that restrict various different aspects. We don't look at kind of the capitalism that occurs that have been created to create certain people out of certain
right, perpetuating these systemic racist policies.
Yeah, yeah. And until we get governments that understand the systematic and institutional ways that we restrict people, particularly people of color and black folk, then, you know, we're always going to see this concept of discrimination as something that's individual. And that's not the way to kind of approach, you know, aspects, particularly when we're supposed to be in a place that lost themselves as a city of good neighbors, and who lost themselves as equitable people.
So what role does education play in creating a more equitable society and challenging the status quo?
Yeah, education is probably top three, right? For you to have a healthy democracy, you have to have a healthy educational system. And when we look at a topic of history that I teach, you know, you cannot have a strong democracy if your history education is poor, right? Because history kind of sets the foundation for everything.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't think people really realize that, right? It's like, What's one of the first things that the doctor asks you when you go to the doctor? He asks about your medical history.
Yep.
Right? Because he can predict what's going to happen if you continue to do different things based on your medical and family history, right?
Mm-hmm.
Your credit score
right.
is based on your history mm-hmm. because people are trying to predict whether or not you're going to pay your bills, right? You know, so I don't understand why we don't think about our history. If we know our history, we can predict what will happen if we continue on this way, right? You know what I'm saying? And for us, so now we're going to be a little bit more knowledgeable about these policies that we're in. Right. And more knowledgeable about, you know, doing various different things, you know, that, you know, people can kind of identify and hopefully push forward with something different.
Talk to me about resiliency, because we've run down three instances, mm-hmm. Juneteenth, Tulsa, Buffalo, where Black resiliency is shown through. How do we do it? How do we keep doing it? How do we keep persevering?
You know what is sad, right? It's sad what I'm going to say, because it just seems like we expect it. We expect oppression.
Uh-huh.
We understand it's there. So we're just waiting for it to happen. Right.
Yes.
While we're living our life. Right.
The other shoe is always going to drop.
Yeah. So I think that's why we get so upset with folk, particularly Black folk, that may say, oh, no, this is not, no, this is not, oh, yeah, we're progressing. And we're just like, okay, all right, well, we'll see, right?
Yeah,
we're just kind of waiting and just living our lives. And because of that, sometimes our home lives as we grow up are not as healthy as they should be, right? Because we have parents and other caregivers that push us.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes a little bit too hard, because we understand that for us to survive in this system, for us to be resilient, we have to do things a little bit better. We can't mess up, right? We have to be in the straight and narrow. We can't be doing this. We can't be doing that. And,
right.
You know,
we got to look a certain way. We got to talk a certain way.
We have to look a certain way, talk a certain way. And, you know, for us to think that we're quote unquote successful. So we're resilient in that particular aspect. We have this grit, but like sometimes is that good for our mental health?
No.
Right?
Or our physical health.
Yeah. I mean, as a kid, like, we're telling kids, don't you act up in the store.
Yeah, right.
don't you do it. You know, you're not getting that. You're not getting, you know, and you know, at dinner you have to do it. And then the other kids are looking at other kids and they're playing and they're running around and they're free. And you know what I'm saying? You're looking at your mother and your mother looking at you like, you better not, right? Type of accident, uh-huh. right? So this pursuit of perfectionist is really tough. So while we laud that as something that, hey, you know, we need to be excellent, right? Sometimes that excellence can be damaging.
Yeah.
You know,
detrimental in a lot of ways.
Right. To our emotional aspects. But after that, I was talking to a friend of mine the other day, and we were watching something and something happened. I forget. And we just said, man, Black folk don't take nothing serious. Like, you know, because we joke about everything.
Everything.
No matter how bad it is or whatever, we just joke about it. So there's the uniqueness to us. Right.
Right.
Where we understand that stuff could happen and most likely will happen. And we're surprised if it doesn't happen.
Mm-hmm.
Right. To us, just enjoying ourselves and being who we are.
We are very good at dulling the pain in a humorous way.
Yeah.
It's like, I don't know anyone else who can do that.
Yeah, I mean, and that's the healthy side, I think, that kind of balances out the pressures of, you know, being a Black person who's trying to, you know, do major things in our society, right? It's that, man, I have to do this, and, you know, and it's tough. It's mm-hmm. tough, but we are resilient. But then we also have to question, are we being too resilient, you know, when we don't have to even live like that sometimes?
Right, and when it's too much and we show emotion,
mm-hmm.
we get criticized for it.
Oh man, yeah. And that's so poorly. You know, I have a wonderful colleague, Brittany Jones, who just joined us at the University of Buffalo, and her research is focused on the concepts of emotionality,
mm-hmm.
right? You know, in Blackness and in history. And what she found was. And the reason why I'm saying this is because history kind of mirrors the way that we treat people in the present, right? So what we learn, typically we learn how to treat people through what we know of them, right? Mm-hmm. And what her dissertation study kind of focused on, you know, Virginia and the emotions of Black people in the curriculum. And what she found was that within the curriculum, there was always these instances of white peoples and their emotions. White people were fearful that Black people would attack them. White people were fearful of this, so they did that. They were scared. And mm-hmm. while there were instances of oppression on Black people in that curriculum, they never mentioned their emotions. They never mentioned whether they were scared. They never mentioned whether they had these rageful or whatever. And it goes back to our previous conversation about this concept of nonviolence. And like, we just have to sit there and just take it, mm-hmm. right? And if we show any type of emotions that rage, then all of a sudden we're demonized.
And then that violence becomes twofold against us.
Exactly. And what's interesting about the whole thing, this country was created based on violence. Mm-hmm. Violence is in our natural fabric. You know,
it's as American as apple pie.
It is, right? So, I mean, no one said, hey, you know, the colonists should have marched on, you know, for King George, right? No, they threw some tea overboard. Mm-hmm. No, they had a war, right? They had all this stuff for their freedom, and we celebrate that. But if Black folk have a little, you know, social unrest because of police brutality or because of anything, then it's like, oh, look at them. They can't control their emotions. Why are they tearing up their own communities, et cetera, right, et cetera, right? And the way in which we understand Blackness, you know, through our understanding of Black people, is really detrimental, as you said.
I want to pivot to your Black Nerds group. Mm-hmm. Can you refresh our audience about what this group is about?
Oh, Black History Nerds, we're just a bunch of nerds that wake up on Saturday mornings to learn about Black history, right? I'm the HNIC, the head nerd in charge. And for our younger listeners, you need to watch Lean On Me if you haven't watched one of the best teacher movies out there. Mm-hmm. But Black History Nerds happens every second Saturday of the month, starting in September and again May. We have a Black History Nerds every weekend or every Saturday in February. But this is just a place where for hour where people can come and just learn about Black history topics, Black life and culture. One of our highlights people loved this past year is that we had a presentation, and everyone can go to the website and watch the archives of the shows, but our first Black History Nerds session dealt with gentlemen who were on what the scholar would say life row, which most people would know death row, right? Right. And, you know, we talked about the prison, you know, system and what goes on in the prison system. And those gentlemen actually wrote a curriculum, a social studies curriculum that, you know, the researcher Rachel will have out very soon that we'll have on our website soon as well. And then our second to last one, we had a professor from Georgetown talk about Black elephants in the room. So we talked about the concepts of Black conservatives, right?
That's interesting.
Yeah. And I really wanted this session because I always tell people, I said, you know what? Black people are more conservative than people think.
Right.
You know.
Especially when we talk about the churches.
Yeah. Yeah. The churches and just all these particular things. The problem is there's a difference between Black conservatives and Black Republicans. Right. You know, are those who vote Republican who consider themselves conservative. Right. So, you know, we had a lovely session on that. A little fiery. Right. Mm-hmm. Session or whatever the case may be. More fiery than other sessions. But I think it was very educative.
And then you've got something coming up, micro-credential.
Yes. So starting in the fall of 2024, we're starting a new teaching Black history micro-credential for educators and other people who are proponents of Black history education. And what this does is this micro-credential will help those who are going into the classroom, those who want to do community work around Black history, become better Black history and more effective Black history teachers. One of the problems we have historically, there hasn't been major problems in creating Black history courses in our schools. Mm-hmm. The problem has always been who will teach those classes.
Right.
Because those teachers are kind of the promotion for the class. So if you have a poor teacher of Black history, then those classes are not going to be successful. If you have a great teacher of Black history, those classes and those programs will become successful. So the micro-credential kind of acts as that educative process for people who are already teachers, those who are training to be teachers, those who want to do community education, you know, to teach more effectively. So we're starting that fall of 24, and the micro-credential will last about a year, you know, from September to July, concluding with the Teaching Black History Conference.
Mm-hmm. That was LeGarrett King. This weekend, the University at Buffalo will be hosting its 7th Teaching Black History Conference, with this year's theme being Black to the Future, Afrofuturism as Black History. Jay Moran sits with LeGarrett to discuss the conference and what to expect this weekend.
And of course, a big event for you and for your center, the Teaching Black History Conference, this coming weekend. I'll let you give the title because it's an intriguing title.
Yeah, this is our 7th total Teaching Black History Conference, which is our signature conference through the center. And it's our 3rd one here in Buffalo, New York. The theme this year is Black to the Future. Afrofuturism is Black History.
Sure. Let's explore that. We've talked a little bit about Afrofuturism on this program before. Well, to talk about why now, why this might be the time to introduce this and bring some thinkers in to kind of share their experience.
Yeah, I think that there's a fatigue, right? Mm-hmm. I think for certain aspects of Black history, right? Particularly Black history that kind of centers on notions of oppression, power, and anti-Blackness and racism and oppression, right? There's been a call for more histories that center joy and center what we would call futurism, right? So we're not necessarily simply looking to the past, right, in terms of what has happened in the past, but how can we use the past to help us understand the future? And so we wanted to create a conference that kind of captures that and give a call to see what teachers are doing in the classrooms around aspects of Afrofuturism.
You most certainly have had some success. I was looking online at some of the individuals you're going to have speaking, and it most certainly seems like already there are some classrooms around the country that are employing the idea of utilizing Afrofuturism to teach Black history.
Yeah, we have some wonderful Black history educators around the world and, you know, of course, in the nation and right here in Buffalo. The Teach a Black History Conference kind of serves as that median to have people get to know each other and share resources around these particular concepts, right? So, yeah, when you look at Afrofuturism, we're going to have English language arts teachers who may utilize the concepts of science fiction in their classroom, Black science fiction in their classrooms. You may have some presentations that help you understand how ELA and social studies, how they're working together in terms of centering, you know, Black voices in the future. But, you know, when we look around and think about Black futures or Afrofuturism, we really want to kind of reimagine society without the concepts of white supremacy, the concepts of racism, the concepts of anti-Blackness, and all those aspects, and see what would society look like if Black people were not interrupted by those oppressive elements.
At your initial conference upon moving to Buffalo 2 years ago, I was over at City Honors, and yeah, had the privilege to stop by and spend some time at a couple of the sessions. I was really taken by the interest, how many teachers had come to the conference. So let's first talk about that. What are you hearing from teachers about the value of what they're getting from, like you said, this exchange of ideas? It's not just, you know, not just lectures and take it, but this, you know, a lot of question and answers were going on. What are you hearing from teachers?
Teachers really enjoy the conference, right? And not just teachers, but people who are Black history proponents, people who I would call community educators, right? I think we talked about the Wakanda Alliance earlier, and other, you know, groups that just love to kind of focus on aspects of Black history. They say that is innovative, right? It's innovative. It's very relaxing, right? Because people are like, wow, I'm with people who have similar interests than I do. And you have people from all racial categories and ethnic categories that come together and just talk about Black history. You know what's interesting is that we as a society, as a country, have been trying to figure out how to do Black history education since after the Civil War, right? And we just can't get it right throughout these years, right? So that was kind of the impetus of the conference, is to bring teachers together, K-12 educators together, just to talk about, so what are you doing in your classrooms? And I think it has been a success, you know, particularly for the last few years.
If we can then make that jump back just a little bit, you know, like you said, trying to teach Black history, not quite getting it right, maybe a larger gap than just not quite getting it right. Mm-hmm. Well, explore that a little bit. What have you, you know, what are some of the takeaways as somebody obviously who studies this as a profession?
Yeah, you know, Black history education is very polarizing when it really shouldn't be polarizing, right? And I think the reason why it's really polarizing is we have been, as a society, the collective sure. we have been told a certain story about, you know, America, U.S., world history, right? And typically those stories are, you know, focused on this kind of triumphant, you know, America. Recently, the last few decades, we've come to understand, hey, we made some mistakes, but the history says, hey, we made mistakes, but we corrected these mistakes, right? And we moved forward. So it's a very progressive, overly patriotic history. Now, when you bring other dynamics within that traditional history, then it becomes kind of convoluted, right? So in many ways, when you bring, and I want the audience to kind of think about this notion of perspective taking.
Please. Yeah, right.
So as we begin to start studying history, we should always focus on, well, whose perspective is this history coming from? And just like with anything, when you have different perspectives and different people, those histories look different. And for, you know, Black people and other people who have been historically oppressed, the U.S. world history may not look like the history that we learned in schools, right? Or the narratives may be a little different. So when you have people who are really connected to that history, because history is about identity, right? And I've said that several times here. They're connected to that identity, and that history becomes their identity. And when you say, hey, no, this just didn't happen this way, then people become a little scared, and people become a little angry, and people begin to say, well, that history is not true, right? How can that be true? Because I've learned that history. My people told me that history, et cetera, et cetera. So to go back to your original question, a lot of teachers around the country, some of them are fearful, because they don't know that history, because they've been taught a certain history in K-12 as well.
They may become experts on that history, right?
They become history experts on that history, correct. And so they're just like, okay, wait a minute, I don't know it. So now you become a little apprehensive. You have some people who are fearful because of the potential diabolical nature of Black history, right? When you begin to start talking about racism and oppression and anti-Blackness, and they don't know really how to handle that because their history is so, you know, progressive and happy and all these particular things. So you have those particular dynamics. And then, of course, you know, we understand certain school districts and certain communities are not friendly towards those types of history. So the major problem is Black history is not really the problem per se. It's what Black history is being taught, which is the problem, right? So if that Black history is progressive and patriotic and connects to that traditional narrative, then yes, let's teach Black history. But if that Black history diverges from that, then that's when it becomes a problem.
You know, it's interesting when you talk about it. I would like to think that anybody who appreciates history first knows that it's always unfolding, right? Mm-hmm. You know, we're learning new things every day, whether it's through documents, through narratives, whatever the case may be. But I think I'm also kind of curious, maybe, and maybe we can explore this, just, mm-hmm. You know, I guess, what are people really afraid of?
So we'll go back to the notions of identity and how we connect with history through identity. And one of our first aspects of how we learn history through our family, right? So how would you feel if, you know, you have this idea about your grandfather, right? And your grandfather fought in World War II or
the immigration story, right?
The immigration, right. Yeah. You know, and then all of a sudden someone says, yeah, your grandfather was a very mean person. Right. You know, like right. He was for school segregation. He was for, you know, all these things that some people could argue, well, he was a person of his time, right? You know, whatever, right? And so now you feel like, whoa, wait a minute. Now my grandfather, right? My grandfather took me to church. My grandfather fed me. My grandfather took care of me, right? So there is kind of this cognitive dissonance that occurs when you say, wait a minute, you know, this is not probably the history that, you know, is what we're really feeding. Yes, that may have occurred. But let's tell you about other things that have occurred, right? So people begin to start, okay, wow. And now your identity is challenged, right? And then for other people, history is about power, right? Because there's a certain narrative that some people may say, well, you know, hey, our traditional history used to teach us that, well, there are some people who were more powerful than others, who were more smarter, more intelligent. They, you know, conquered things. They found out, you know, they created things. And now that history becomes kind of an apparatus to say these people are up here and these people are down here, right? So when you begin to interrupt that hierarchy, then people become like, okay, where the power dynamics will disappear. So I'll say something real quick. It's like, well, why is the discourse around affirmative action and DEI so popular and so influential to a lot of people? Because they do feel that people of color, women, are not as intelligent, right? Not as innovative as other people. So they need help, right, to achieve society. In reality, that's not really the case. But because we have a history that says, hey, you know, these particular people are here and these particular people are there, then it becomes something where you can say that makes sense,
right?
Right. Why that person received that promotion. That makes sense why that person received that job and I didn't receive that job or that promotion.
You know, I appreciate the conversation with Dr. LeGarrett King. And as we start getting into, I can feel us maybe getting way too deep here because we only have so much time to talk about the conference. And I want to get back to it as well. I looked at a couple of the topics mm-hmm. and I see one, building a high school Afrofuturism class. Now, obviously, you have an expert coming in to talk about it, but I'm sure you have some understanding about what is going to be shared in this. Let's maybe look inside that just a little bit of what you can tell us about what it might look like to have a classroom like that and how, probably the bigger thing for a teacher, any kind of community educator, how to go about, you know, building that classroom setting, so to speak.
Well, you know, the beautiful thing about having these presentations is that you can just imagine, right, different ways of how to construct that classroom, right? So a lot of people, kind of the traditional way of building Afrofuturism classroom is, let's take a popular fantasy or science fiction book, right? And let's delve into that book, talk about the regular ELA aspects of it, you know, context, the protagonist, the antagonist, et cetera, and for the social studies aspect, hey, let's look at the history of it. Wow, this person, they fought against enslavement, and now this community in Africa, this is how they, you know, achieved without the concepts of, you know, all the oppression, right? You know what I'm saying? So you have that aspect of Afrofuturism. You also have an aspect of Afrofuturism, which I think goes under the radar, right? It's one of those aspects where you can build a class where you learn history, right? And in this case, Black history, and you allow students to take what they learned and try to apply it to a current issue where they could fix that issue based on the history that they've learned and then create an action plan for the future to solve that particular issue. Right. So in simpler terms, what if a student is really interested in civil rights history and they would like to be someone who would like to be a civil rights activist in the future? How can you take the similarities and the differences between the 1960s civil rights movement and, let's say, Black Lives Matter? What are the similarities? What are the differences? What were the mistakes that these two groups, right, did to make them successful? And to not make them successful, how would you build a social justice organization based on your understandings of those two organizations, right? So that could be a possibility in terms of making your class Afrofuturism. So it doesn't have to be science fiction. It doesn't have to be fantasy. It's all about what I like to call letting students dream.
Right.
We don't allow our students to dream anymore in classrooms. It's all about tests, right? It's all about lecture. It's all about this. It's all about that. But we don't allow our students to dream. And we fail to realize that every great invention that we have now was first a dream. You know, Apple was a dream, right? Your architecture, the way in which we, you know, do architecture, all those things were dreams at first by someone who was allowed to make that dream official later on in the past.
I like the way that you say that, allow a student to dream. It's, I mean, it's a great concept. I did a lot of daydreaming when I was in class, not so much dreaming.
Well, I think I think I saw a meme one day that said, don't ask your kids what they want to B, when they grow up, ask your kids what they want to solve when they grow up.
Ah.
Right? You know what I'm saying? So now you have that particular aspect.
So it's really, I mean, it kind of falls under that great term, critical thinking, right?
Yes, definitely.
And it's a way to spark kids in a lot of different ways. I guess I'll ask this question, and I think I already know the answer, but I'll like let you explore it a little bit. You know, I think there's a certain hope inside being able to teach Afrofuturism in the classroom would help, you know, Black students, especially, you know, students who might be coming from difficult backgrounds. But what, you know, but that's not the only kid in the classroom.
Mm-hmm.
So I would like to think that there's a lot of benefits, of course, for kids who are not necessarily Black and looking for identity in that regard. I might explore that a little bit if you'd like.
Well, you know, history is the first time that we learn about ourselves, but it's also the first time we learn about someone who would other from us, right? So it's pretty difficult to have a successful democracy when the only knowledge you have when half of the population doesn't know anything about you, right? You know what I'm saying? So if they know nothing about you, then when they become decision makers, whether they're, you know, police officers, whether they're judges, whether they're teachers, whether they're anyone that has dominion over anyone, it's important for them to understand your history so they can kind of understand, okay, why is this person acting this way? Or why were those decisions made without thinking from their perspective, right? Remember, we're all about this notion of perspective taking, right? It's like not everyone in this country, not everyone in this world thinks alike, right? And this is very difficult because here you're trying not to essentialize, right? You're not trying to say this person is this based on that, but really kind of understanding their history, you can say, ah, that's the reason why, and how can I help, you know, facilitate this conversation? How can I help this person, you know, et cetera, et cetera. So history is very important in that particular context.
And we don't necessarily have to get into the cases, but there are cases around the country where certain aspects of Black history in school districts, and state levels, mm-hmm. you know, a lot of the things that we've been just talking about here in the last 15 minutes are being pushed back.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
But we all now have a national conversation that's coming up here in this presidential election. What are you hearing that maybe is a concern of yours? And do you see this kind of playing into some of the things that we're going to be hearing about in the next couple of months?
You know,
tough questions.
It's a tough question, and I really don't want to imagine, but I know it's coming, right?
Yeah.
It's this notion that, you know, these histories make white people feel bad or white children feel bad, or these histories do damage to how we understand who we are. So here's the thing for people who were like against Black Lives Matter, right? You wouldn't have a Black Lives Matter movement if Black Lives Mattered in the schools. When we ignore, right, and restrict histories of a certain people, that is telling us and telling you that we don't respect your humanity in the classrooms. We don't respect you. We don't respect your perspectives. We don't respect what happened to you. We don't respect how you think about different things. That's what those policies do, right? And that's very dangerous, particularly for people who claim that they're for, you know, democracy, or claim that they are for equality, and claim that, you know, hey, they want, you know, people to be inclusive, right? Those restrictions tell those children that you don't matter, and we don't care about you saying that, you know, you don't matter, et cetera, right?
Right.
So I predict that it's going to be, you know, really ugly.
Mm.
But I also predict that there's probably going to be some movements to help push forward ethnic studies and push forward Black histories in our schools and in our states.
You feel confident no matter what happens here in the coming months that that's going to continue?
Yeah. You know, when the Stop Woke Act in Florida started, there were churches who began to start having Black history courses and classes, right? Right now you have 14 states that have what I would call Black history mandates. Black history has to be taught in their classrooms, right? So yeah, I mean, you know, there has always been advocacy and agency with Black communities to ensure that their Black histories are being taught. So it may not be taught in schools who have legislation or policies, but we can definitely see an uptick in communities.
want to make sure that we talk about the conference before we say goodbye on this segment of What's Next, but it is coming up this weekend. It's called Black to the Future, Afrofuturism as Black History, and the conference runs, what, Friday, Saturday, and Sunday, right?
Yeah, so Friday and Saturday will be our face-to-face, mm-hmm. University at Buffalo South Campus and Diefendorf Hall. So that will run maybe from 8 to around 4 o'clock. Friday, we have a lovely reception, right, for people who want to party. And then Sunday will be all virtual. So we'll start virtual learning from 9 to around 3, 4 o'clock on Sunday.
And registration's still a possibility?
Yeah, there's several different ways that you can do registration. So online, so you can, you know, Google the Center for K-12 Black History Education, and you can register online there. We can facilitate in-person.
Okay.
Registration. And also, I don't know how you all would do this, but I do have 2 donated tickets that an audience member can claim. So I don't know if
they could reach out to you probably.
Yeah. So the first 2 people who listen to the show and would like to come to the conference, you can email me at lagarret@buffalo.edu.
That, of course, is Dr. LeGarrette King. And, you know, Doctor, I can't help. It's interesting because when I talk to you, you have this way of intellectualizing these very complex answers, and they come through with a lot of what I sense is hope. Mm-hmm. You have that moving forward.
I have what is called a critical hope, right? And by critical hope, I'm like, okay, no matter what happens, right, I think that the aspects of Black history will push forward, right? As I said, we've been doing this, particularly like Black communities and Black teachers and Black society, persons like Carter G. Woodson and even Booker T. Washington and Lilo Amos Pendleton and Merle Epps and August A. Johnson, right? These people early on in the early 20th century would push aspects of, you know, Black history into their classrooms and just push it. And, you know, no matter what people from the outside state, there's a hunger for Black history. Everywhere I go, right, someone always has a story about Black history, right?
Right.
You know, for me, whether they know a lot or whether they did things or even if they didn't know a lot, right, you know, they always ask me about Black history no matter where I go, right? Friend, foe, or file. I have no idea, but they always, you know, create those conversations with me.
And, you know, speaking of which, it also gives us just a chance to touch in on something that you have coming up that the center is going to be involved in. Mm. And that's the 70th anniversary of Brown versus the Board of Education. And you're looking to bring that connection here to the city of Buffalo as well, right?
Yeah, definitely. One of our programs that we like to do through the center is our Western New York event, right? And this coming fall, hopefully, we will have our Western New York event around the 7th anniversary of Brown versus the Board of Education. And what I would like to do, and if you're interested, please email me. What I would like to do is have community members who were one of the first who integrated schools in Buffalo, and let's hear about your perspectives and hear. You know, a few years ago, maybe a year ago, I did something with Buffalo Public Schools through Dr. Fatima Morrell, you know, had an event in February, and I had a session, and I talked about this notion of desegregation, and I had some senior Buffalo citizens in the classroom, and I mean, they were brought to tears about their experiences integrating, I think, South Buffalo, right?
Right?
And I think it would be a powerful event, and I can't wait to start advertising for it. We also have our Black History Nerd series that we have every second Saturday of each month, and our October 12th event will focus on the Democratic Party and Black millennials, and the speaker here will kind of talk about the kind of declining support for Democrats with Black millennials. So I'm really excited about that leading up to the election.
Wow, there's a topic. I might just stop the tape and we'll talk for that for an hour. That sounds like a great one because, boy, it most certainly is popping up on the national level, that's for sure. Mm-hmm. Well, Dr. King, as always, really appreciate you coming in and joining us on What's Next, and we look forward to future conversations as well.
I appreciate you having me.
And that will do it for Producers Picks. We thank our guest, LeGarrette King. If you missed anything or want to hear it again, you can get this program as a podcast wherever you get your podcasts. Each episode is online at wbfo.org. I'm Thomas O'Neill White. Thanks for listening.